I'm James Finlayson and you're listening to The Life Aquatic on Boat Radio. Each week, The Life Aquatic will feature the story of someone who lives their life on board a boat, who's left dry land behind and has committed themselves to a life on water with all the challenges and all the rewards that that brings. This week, we're going to have the story of Dini and Pablo Martinez and family from Sydney, Australia. And we'll hear the story of their adventures later in the programme. But first, Dini, take us back to your earliest sailing experiences.
My grandpa took me sailing when I was a little girl. That's when I first started, so about the age when I started walking.
Where was that and what sort of boat were you on?
That was, he had first a Jeannot, later a Beneteau around the 8 and then 10 metre mark. And that was on Lake Constance, actually. I grew up in Europe, so it was more lake sailing to start with.
Would you say that you've been confident around boats then since you can remember?
Yeah, absolutely. And I grew up with that dream of sailing the big oceans. Then a bit later, after high school, I ended up working on the big yachts for a few years as well, doing the Caribbean and the Mediterranean back and forth for a few years. And then from there, I always had this dream of doing it on my own boat, of getting a bunch of friends together, buying an old boat, redoing it and sailing into the sunset. And somehow everyone seemed to be excited about the idea, but no one really chopped in. No one was as keen as I was to, you know, invest the time and the money and all that it would have needed. And then all of a sudden I was married and all of a sudden I had kids and I still had this dream, and that's pretty much the background.
So just going back to when you were working on the super yachts, it's very obvious these days that you're obviously a yoga teacher, you're somebody who's got a philosophy of life that's very sort of sharing and caring. So did that experience of working on those boats where you were with the super wealthy, was that something that set you in a certain direction of seeing how people live their lives?
Well, it was even before that I don't know where I got it from, but I always was quite disturbed by that imbalance in this world between rich and poor countries, and even within a country, you know, between rich and poor. And I ended up in the super yachts because the last few years of high school I did in Antibes, where I was exposed to the super yachts, I guess. And it was easy to get weekend holiday jobs, and that's how I slid into it. The moment I finished school, it was just too tempting. It was too much money and too much glamour, I guess, to reject, although it really wasn't. I mean, the sailing was exciting, but I really didn't want to polish an already polished boat off a super rich person. I much rather wanted to work in Africa or South America with some poorer communities. So that's why then after a few years, one summer in the Caribbean, I also jumped off in Cuba and said that was enough now.
Well, so you jumped off in Cuba. What happened after that?
I had the time of my life, although I got robbed a few days into that experience sort of had to manage. I ended up on another boat, actually, after a month of somehow surviving in Cuba, thanks to the hospitality of the Cuban people, who it was just amazing.
So from those early days, what was the journey through life that took you to Australia?
I ended up working in a few development projects in South America then, after Cuba, and realized after a few years that if I really wanted to change something in the big scale, people would only listen if I had a university degree. And I knew I was going to study in English. I didn't want to go back to the UK where I'd gone to boarding school. I didn't want to go to the US either. So that left me with just a few. Canada was too cold, so I started randomly applying for universities in Australia. And sure enough, got a scholarship. And yeah, that's how I ended up here. And that is now a good 13 years ago.
We'll get onto the voyages with the family in a bit. But obviously, yoga is central to your life. So how did yoga come into your life?
At the same time as I started university, I found yoga. I had an amazing teacher up in Queensland, and he got me pretty quickly into the meditation part of it as well. I did a few 10-day silent meditation retreats, and it was just the home that I never had, because I grew up all over Europe, mainly in boarding schools. From the age of 6, I wasn't living with my parents anymore. I sort of had never had any roots, and when I found yoga and meditation, I found that, I guess, what they call home within yourself, and it was life changing. It just made me rest much more within.
Can you expand a bit more on that about how you found a home with it?
Well, you know, before, with all that excitement and adventure that I always had in my life, it was always ups, and like the highs were very high, the lows were very low, and there was nothing really to catch me if they were, because the ties to my family weren't that strong because I hadn't grown up with them. I didn't have a place to go back to if things, you know, the shit hit the fan. And the moment I started yoga, it was just that realization, I guess, you know, the same as Hinduism, Buddhism, they talk about that as well, that the only place where you can feel at home, it's not on the outside, it's an inner sensation. And some people might get there through outside places or through other people, but in the end, if you can find that place within yourself, then that's all you need in this world. And you can, you know, you can never fall really deeply anymore. You can always pull yourself back out, because you yourself, you're the only person who's always going to be there for you.
So we're joined by somebody very small there. Tell us about her.
Oh, can you hear the baby?
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, she's just feeding. She's just 2 months old, so she's still struggling with some words to throw in the interview.
Okay, what's her name?
India.
India, okay. Well, we'll see if we can get India worked into the interview. But talking about yoga, I think from talking to a lot of people who go sailing, particularly the ones who live aboard, yoga seems something very popular among boat owners. From the perspective of somebody sailing, just talk us through why yoga is something good for somebody who's sailing or living on board a boat.
Well, I can tell you the physical things, but I think more interesting is the whole mental journey you go through. That yoga talks a lot about unity, that everything is actually one. So it comes back to the body sensations, which comes back to the vibration of the cells, and sort of what the Western scientists in recent years have started to prove through their science. That's what Buddha has been teaching for thousands of years. And that unity, when it comes to sailing, I think it's very much the same or similar path, because if you don't work with the ocean, with the wind, with the forces of nature, it's just not going to work. You can't fight them. They're always stronger than you. And then on top of that, you know, there's certain virtues like patience. My husband says in the background. Do you want to elaborate on that, Pablo? You can come in if you want.
Can I?
Yeah.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. Yeah, so is Dini bringing you in there to talk about yoga as well?
Well, for me, it's been I'm still not into yoga that much, to be honest. I actually, one of the things I enjoy about yoga is acro yoga, which is like one version of the many yogas you can find. But I can definitely relate with that yoga obviously will help you with the patience, because it's obviously a lot of challenges when you sail.
So talking about sailing, Pablo, when did you get into sailing? Was it something that Dini got you into, or were you a sailor before you met?
No, definitely it was something that Dini brought into my life. Before that, I only had one sailing trip in Queensland with some friends. But definitely she was the one that showed me and taught me how to enjoy the whole thing about sailing, which is, you know, being in tune with the wind, with the elements. And once that you sort of learn how to enjoy that, it's amazing. It's just caught me, and then there was no turning back. I was totally in it. So when she told me about her dream, she always have a dream of sailing around the world or buying a boat, I said, yeah, let's do it. And I never had second thought.
Yeah, so did you guys have a boat in Australia before you decided to become adventurers?
We bought a share in a boat, basically the moment we got together, so that we could up Pablo's sailing skills mainly, well, and obviously enjoy the beautiful Sydney Harbour. But it was one of the best choices, because we're comparing the costs of that to running him through all the courses, and it was by far more enjoyable, and we got much more time on the water in that way.
Most people have heard of Sydney, but what's the sailing community like there? Are there a lot of sailors or a lot of boats?
Funny that you ask, because next week we're going to be presenting at the Sydney Boat Show, and I'm just putting together my presentation for that. And I've asked myself that question as well. Now, the majority of the sailing community in Sydney, which is rather big, is, how to put it without sounding, you know, too negative, they're double or triple our age, and they probably have 10 times, no, or 100 times more money in their bank accounts than us, if that makes sense. So yeah. it's rather elitist, or, you know, there's obviously the exceptions to the rule, but because it's such an expensive city, it's a beautiful city, but it's a very expensive city, especially when it comes to sailing, that tends to be more the kind of person on the water.
And are there places, maybe not in Sydney, but where people can get into the water and it's not an elitist thing, where they can do it and it's affordable?
Well, the way we did it is one of the most affordable ways, that buying a share in a boat. Or the other way is if you are into dinghy sailing, or, you know, really small boat sailing, there's a few sailing clubs where you can get involved for sure. And then the third option is going up to Pittwater, if you know the geography. So there's Port Jackson, which is the Sydney harbour. Generally, that's what people think of when they think of Sydney. And then just an hour north is Pittwater, which is another natural, elongated, huge harbour with lots of sort of bays that go off it, where it's a lot cheaper to keep a boat. So that's the other option for people, just to go up there.
I'm James Finlayson, and you're listening to The Life Aquatic on Boat Radio.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.
I'm Michael John, and each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames. From the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel, to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures, I'll be meeting the people, visiting the places, and boarding the ships that work this mighty, muddy artery. So join me, Michael John, for Tales of the Thames on Boat Radio.
I'm James Finlayson, and you're listening to The Life Aquatic on Boat Radio. Each week on this programme, we talk to someone who has abandoned dry land for life on a boat, and who has decided that their dreams of adventure and exploration must become reality. This week, I'm talking to Dini and Pablo Martinez from Sydney, Australia. I continued by asking them a question straight from their own website. And the question is, why would a family leave behind their secure jobs and home in suburbia Sydney for a nomadic life around the globe?
Yeah, why would we? Because we were dreamers rather than realists, but still, obviously, with that enough of realism to make it happen. Because we saw all our friends getting into the mortgage kind of deal, sort of trying to find contentment in the rat race, and it was nothing that ever had appealed to any of us, neither Pablo nor myself. And also the children came into that a bit because we follow our hearts, not really our heads. So we thought it was nice to have a baby, and we didn't really think how that was going to be combined with the sailing dream. But in fact, it made it even more real, because the moment Noah, our first one, was born, again, you rethink the values that you want to pass on to your children. And for me, one of the most, if not the most beautiful thing to be alive is is the planet itself, and exploring and being on the water as well, discovering new cultures, new people, and just having that challenge, but also that tremendous satisfaction that you get when you're out there in the water and you just feel that oneness with nature. So that is something I wanted to pass on to my children. Thus, we did do, you know, we did it because of the children also, not despite the children.
What sort of gap was there between you having the spark of the idea and then selling up and leaving?
Look, I always had the idea in my mind. Then I met Pablo in
2009.
A year later, we were married. A year later, we had a child. And already when I met him, I mentioned that dream just to make sure he knew what he was getting himself into. And like you heard before from him, he was happy to embrace it. So it was always an idea. But I think the moment Noah was born, and it coincided when we were at the Sydney Boat Show listening to another family who'd just come back from their adventure doing a similar thing that we did, and made it more real. And we started to really look at the steps we needed to make it reality. So we started setting a savings goal. And we also were still waiting for Pablo's citizenship to come through. So those were the two major milestones. Then came the second son, rather unexpected, but that happened to, his birth happened to coincide with the day, well, the day after we got the citizenship. And we also around that time had then achieved our savings goal. And that was 4 years after we met. And then from that moment on, it was 3 months to sell everything, resign our jobs, renounce the lease, and then we were gone. And during all those years when we were saving, we also looked at as many boats as we could on the weekends, mainly in New South Wales. A couple of times we flew up to Queensland, because first the idea was to buy a boat here and then slowly, step by step, move on board. And after however many months we'd feel ready, we'd start sailing the Australian East Coast up north.
So you were thinking of sailing around Australia, but you ended up in Europe. So what happened there?
Because while we were saving and searching for a boat, we realized that the European or the Mediterranean market for blue water cruises was A, much bigger, and B, seemingly cheaper. And then came the added benefit of me having family in Europe, so we could have, you know, we had a point sort of to stay with them, and hopefully we're hoping see them a bit more often if we were saving in that area. And last but not least, it seemed safer to start that whole journey, especially with children in the Mediterranean, where you don't have cyclones and other extreme weather events that can hit you here in Australia.
For me, it's my first time. It was going to be my first time in Europe. So for me, it was quite attractive to start in Europe.
But your first adventure in Europe was with a camper van rather than a boat, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Was that planned, or did you just fall into that?
It was sort of planned, because we didn't want to buy the boat without having seen it. So after, you know, for years looking in Australia, we sort of had refined our search. We knew we wanted a centre cockpit. We knew we wanted something around the 40-foot mark. And we obviously had our budget to work with. And then the idea was getting a camper van and driving around the whole European coastline, like around the ports, and find our boat. So that was the plan. I think we didn't think it was going to take as long as it did. It took about 6 months.
But we also chose the motorhome because of practicality, because we were with kids, and we thought, oh, but if we have to travel and take a plane, it's going to be expensive, and all the logistics. So we say, well, what if we go and see the boat with the motorhome, and we have our own home, and just going to be somehow easier.
Through that journey, going around all the different ports and all the places, did you then find somewhere that you wanted to spend more time in, that you where you wanted to kind of have your boat?
We were quite impatient just to find the boat. That was the main thing. We weren't so much after a place at that stage. Getting more impatient by the day, because living in a motorhome of 7 meters with a family of four, it can get a bit small and tense at times. And especially also going from a life, the typical, I guess, family life in a city, where you see your partner maybe an hour during weekdays, you know, half an hour in the morning, half an hour or two in the evening. to being together 24/7 on such a small space, that wasn't easy. So we were quite keen and impatient to find out about it.
And the boat you eventually settled on was a Moody 425. Now, this is Boat Radio, so feel free to be a complete boat geek and tell us all about why the Moody 425 was the perfect boat for you.
Okay, well, first we hadn't thought about Moody's because we saw another model a long time ago in Australia which really hadn't caught our fancy. We were quite enchanted first by the Harbour Grassies, but after a few wooings, we realised that our budget was never going to make that. Then we had a little enchantment by Amels and
the Ocean Lord. So one of the models is the Ocean Lord, the Westerlies.
The Westerlies.
Westerlies.
Sorry, Westerlies. And once in the south of France, just before crossing over to Spain, we were viewing an Amel. And that just as we were about to say goodbye to the broker, we saw that Moody. And it was a center cockpit. It was 42 foot. So that fit our criteria. It looked rather nice. It had a teak deck, this one. So we just, by accident, asked him if he could have a look. And the moment we walked on it, we knew that maybe not that particular boat, but you know, the Moody 425 engine, that was our boat. Until we saw the Moody's, we never thought it possible with our budget and with our size to have a spare cabin that we could use for guests and to have two bathrooms. And the way that Bill Dixon laid out the boat is just incredibly, he uses the space incredibly well. And from that moment, it was just about finding our right Moody 425. That one was too expensive mainly because of the teak deck and a stubborn French owner. But it was love at first sight. From that moment, we knew that that was our boat. So the rest, touring Spain and Portugal and back up to France, was mainly just focusing on that.
So you'd narrowed it down and then the quest went on. So tell us about the moment you did find the right boat.
Well, I think we hit a low point when actually we arrived to the UK, because it was our best last hope. Obviously, UK being the country where the Moody's come from. We saw a couple, I think, and we were quite disappointed. And we were like, what are we going to do? So I told Dini, well, there is this Moody 425 from a German owner that I contacted before we started the trip. On the internet, I found it. So I contacted that owner again, and he said, yeah, I'm still on sale. Do you want to come to see it? So I said, well, I think it's worth the effort and the money to take a flight. And
that boat was in Greece, and at that point, we'd been living in the camper van for 6 months. We were in the UK in November. It was freezing cold. We were there with two kids, and it was just the last hope, really. So I sent Pablo off to go and have a look at it, because again, we were trying to save. We'd already spent, you know, lots of money that we had hoped to spend once we were on the boat. And just as he'd left the airport, I went back to the van. The gas broke down. My credit card got stolen as I was in the freezing hail with my kids. It was pretty much, it's either this boat or we fly back home to Australia and give up. And the day later, Pablo called me and he just said he walked on it and knew it was our boat.
After seeing so many boats, it was amazing just to walk inside the boat and you see, right, this is it. I just felt it.
And I think we learned since then, buying a boat is always an emotional decision. Yeah, of course, you do have all the criteria that you try and meet, but in the end, it's a feeling. And people had told us that before, but I guess until it happens to you, it doesn't make sense. And when it does, you just know.
Well, I guess it's not just transport, is it? It's your home, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So from that cold November day, that low point in London, and Pablo found the boat, how long was it from then until you were all on board the boat? Did it need work doing, or were you straight out to Greece to get on board?
But it was pretty well maintained, which was another thing we had started looking for, because had we not had the kids, we would have, you know, loved to take on a project boat. But because of the kids, it was just, we weren't in a position to do so. So it was ready to move on board. It had all the solar panels, wind vane, you name it. But it was November and we didn't want to start living on the boat in winter conditions in the Med. So we decided, while we're in the UK, why don't we try and earn a bit of money to get us through the next season. So we did. We were quite lucky. Pablo pretty quickly found a contract job. He's an accountant, and I set up my yoga classes in Winchester, which is where he's working, near Winchester. So we stayed there for a good 5 months, topping up our kitty, and then when spring came, we flew down and moved aboard.
You named the boat Happy Dancer. Where did that name come from?
No, we didn't name it Happy Dancer. It was Happy Dancer already.
Okay.
And we sort of followed the old suspicion, you know, that changing the name of a boat brings bad luck, or if you do so, you have to change the point underneath the mast. And we definitely weren't willing to go through the lifting of the mast just to change the coin. And then we didn't want to challenge fate either. So that's why we just stuck with Happy Dancer.
And, originally, the boat was called Blue Dancer. So that's how the first owner called the boat. And then the second owner didn't like it because for him it was, you know, the blues. He was relating to the blues. So he thought that was sort of bad luck. So he changed it to Happy Dancer.
It seems like a nice positive name anyway. So this is now, is it spring of 2014 and you're on the boat. Did you then come up with a big plan for where to go, or did you decide to set off and just see what happened?
We're not the big plan kind of people, otherwise we probably never have done it. We, I think at that stage we would have decided that the next winter we would want to spend working but also living on the boat. And language-wise, the only two countries that's possible were Spain or Malta. So it had to be English or Spanish. And Spain we would have loved, but given the economy there, especially back then, that wasn't an option. So we decided to go for Malta, and that influenced then our cruising route. So that's why we went up the peninsula through the canal into the Ionian Sea, and from there in autumn then headed over to Sicily for a month and then down to Malta.
That list of places sounds amazing. What were some of the highlights of that first trip?
Probably, I think we'd just gone through the Corinth Canal and we were the only boat that it was a night we went through, the only boat going through. It was quite magical and wind picked up. So we just decided to use that and keep going through the night. The kids were sleeping and it got up to a good 20, no, probably more 30, 35 knots. And we had enough of innocence still to not really realize that it could potentially have gotten much stronger, which luckily it didn't. But we also had enough knowledge and confidence in ourselves and the boats to just enjoy that. And I think that was the first moment we were not in freaking out panic mode, because there was so much to learn and the kids and everything. That was the first moment we could just be there and sail, and what we were talking about earlier, feel that unity, that oneness with nature. So, and it didn't even, like, normally you're tired in the night. We didn't feel tired at all. We were just in bliss there, cruising along at probably, what, 7-8 knots all the way to Galaxidi, which then ended up being one of the highlights as well. Galaxidi is a place where we moored for a few days and saw the Oracle of Delphi. And yeah, that was probably one of the first big highlights.
I guess there's a big gap between that really romantic way you've just described it and the actual practicality of sailing a boat, because it's not easy, is it?
No, not at all. Less so with a baby and a toddler on board. And absolutely. And that you really have to want it, and you have that romantic idea and that notion, that feeling of whatever it is that you get out of a sailing adventure has to be so strong, and you have to value it so much that it makes worth fighting for. Because there is obviously lots of challenges and lots of hard moments. It's not all beautiful at all. But if that living that dream is a strong enough wish for you, then it's all worth it.
I'm James Finlayson, and you're listening to The Life Aquatic on Boat Radio.
Earliest prehistory reveals mankind's innate connection to the sea. From boats of woven reed in Egypt, to Homer's black ships of the Trojan War, down to the naval battles of Greece, Rome, and every civilization since. I'm Brandon Huebner, and I'll present the history, archaeology, and literature that connect us with our past on the sea, all that on the Maritime History Program. Join me as we voyage down through the ages and witness the development of sailing, trade, and much more. The Maritime History Program, with me, Brandon Huebner, every Wednesday here on Boat Radio.
We're living our dream.
We're living simply and sustainably aboard a sailboat traveling the world.
We're visiting remote communities and raising awareness about the health of our oceans.
We're trawling the oceans for microplastic particles.
We're checking on the health of coral reefs and phytoplankton populations.
We're monitoring marine mammals and examining synthetic materials in fish.
We're Bass and Jamie Van Jones.
And we're proof that citizen science can save the world.
Hear all about our amazing adventures in salty times every week here on Boat Radio.
Stay salty.
You.
And the board of the ladies say, clear away the tackle, let the boat join run.
I'm James Finlayson, and you're listening to The Life Aquatic on Boat Radio. This week, I'm talking to Dini and Pablo Martinez from Sydney, Australia. As we've already heard, Dini and Pablo left their lives in Sydney, Australia behind and headed to the Mediterranean, where they bought their boat Happy Dancer and embarked on a series of adventures with their young family. But what's it like actually living on board with two very small children? And how safe is it?
That's one of the first questions I've been asked always since coming back to Sydney. And honestly, I felt much safer on the boat with them than here in Sydney because of the traffic and those crazy cars. Because you are always on the boat, you are always conscious of the risks. So you always have an ear out, you always have an eye out, and you adjust, you learn to live with those risks that you can then mitigate rather well by yourself. There's not a third party intervention. So one of the first things we did actually when we got the boat was put netting all around so they couldn't just slip through the lifelines or through the reeling. And then we had certain rules, and that was our rules, but every family that we've met have their different rules. But when we were underway, they would always be tethered onto the boat and wear a life jacket. If we were at anchor, always one of us would be out on deck with them. And it never, ever felt dangerous.
And the flip side of it is you must have been able to give them some great experiences along the way.
Absolutely. I think they've had one of the best early childhood years that you can somehow think of. Because to start with, they have both parents around, which is a luxury all the time. And then they are so spoiled, my kids, by beaches and beautiful places that now when I tell them, shall we go to the beach, they just go, oh, okay, can we do something else for once? But yeah, they just grew up really free, really doing what they felt like and having us around.
So after the first voyage, did you stay on the boat or did you have another winter earning money again?
Both. We stayed on the boat in Malta and were working there.
Oh, I see. Yeah, so you were living on the boat in Malta.
Yes.
And how was that, spending the winter moored in Malta? What was Malta like?
Okay, so one part is spending the winter on the boat, which was in a way nice because we could heat it up really cozily in 2 minutes, whereas all the Maltese houses struggled to stay warm in winter. Of course, there were those rainy, stormy days where you would have loved a bit more space with the kids, but overall it was doable. I would never live in a marina long term because you do have the downside of both life on land and life at sea, just in this small space, but at the same time you are not sailing. But if it's a small or a short time, like for us that winter, then it's a no-brainer. It was definitely worth it. And Malta is an interesting place. It's a tiny island in the middle of the Mediterranean, and yet throughout the centuries, every nation in the Med has probably tried to get a grip on it because of its strategic position. And it's left a bit of that attitude that the Maltese have. They are friendly folk, but they are rather rough on the edges, especially towards foreigners coming in. And I guess, you know, reading up a bit in the history, you understand why, because everyone comes and wants to conquer them. But we were sort of expecting something like the Italians or the Spanish, who are just warm and open-hearted people generally. The Maltese are a very different kind of folk, very interesting. But having said that, there's also a lovely big expat community from all over the place, with all sorts of stories why people end up on the rock. So overall, we had a really great time, and we were so lucky again to find jobs.
So did you wait until the spring again to set off on the boat again?
Yeah, we did. And then when we set off, we crossed over to the Aegean this time. Took a month to sail to Turkey, where I had organized a yoga retreat. And then the rest of the summer we spent sailing Turkey before going back. And then the plan was to cross the Atlantic. So we were going to stop in Malta after Crete and visit some friends, maybe get some stuff from the Chandleries, which are quite well equipped, and then head off to do the big ocean crossing. But life had different plans, as you know.
For the benefit of the listeners, tell us what happened next then.
Well, after that beautiful summer in Turkey, which was another highlight of the whole trip, because we were really at that stage where we felt confident and relaxed on the boat, the kids with each other, we'd found the groove, we'd found our rhythm, we had total trust in our boat. And then a month before we hit Malta, I started all of a sudden feeling sick and sicker and sicker, and that is I very rarely, if ever, got seasick before. And when we hit Malta, I had a craving for meat, and it's been 8 years I'm a vegetarian, and it always happens in the first 2 months of a pregnancy. So I was too suspicious, and I did a test, and that sort of changed the rest of the journey as we were pregnant with our third then.
So then you decided to come back to Australia?
We did, because we always liked the idea of having another child. But I had amazing pregnancies with the boys. So my idea was, even if I'd fall pregnant, we'd just keep going as if nothing had happened. Because that's how I lived my life with my first two pregnancies. Now, this time being pregnant with a girl, it was a completely different story. And I couldn't, like, there was days I couldn't even stand or sit up. And I was still the one in charge of the boats, although Pablo had obviously learned to sail it very well as well. But I wasn't in a position where I could be in charge of a boat and a family to cross an ocean. I felt so horrible. And then we considered spending another winter in Malta, but our mindset had already been out of the Med. Like, we had had an amazing time in the Mediterranean or in Europe in general, but it was time to move on. So it was quite a confusing few months. Me being pregnant, not able to think clearly, Pablo, I don't know what was going on for him, but all of a sudden he freaked out at the thought of being on the boat with three kids rather than two. And in the end, we thought we'd just travel for a while without the boat, thinking that that might make things easier. And we spent a few months in Spain and Morocco. And that was, despite the nice places we saw, it was more of a nightmare than anything else, really, because we'd lost our home. And me being pregnant and the kids being the age they were, we really needed a home. And with Happy Dancer, while we were sailing, we were moving a lot, but we'd always have our home with us. And those few months traveling without the boat was just from one Airbnb to hotel to another Airbnb place. And it completely unrooted us. And at one stage, we didn't know what to do or what to think. So we came back home to re-find our roots somehow.
After, nearly 2 years on board a boat, what was the transition like living in an apartment or a house again?
Practically, it was extremely easy. And even now, people look at me going, how did you do it with three kids and no family support? honestly, it feels like a breeze, because I always compare how this life could have looked like, or having a third one could have looked like, if we'd still on the boat. And in our house, you've got a washing machine, you've got a dishwasher, you just flick the switch and the light comes on. You don't have to calculate anything about what's in the battery or what's in the water tank. It's just so ridiculously easy. And I think probably everyone should have a camper van or boat experience at one point in their life to just appreciate those simple things that we often take for granted. So practically speaking, very easy. My kids, for the first time, are allowed to play hide and seek, because on the boat, that was a big no-go. The moment we called out their names, they had to respond, you know, straight away, because otherwise you'd freak out, they'd fallen in the water. Again, such an easy thing in the house. Emotionally, it's a different thing. There is also an easy part, because you have your community again, which is a great support, and you're not sort of stuck and reliant and dependent on each other all the time. But then there's the other side of it, where you just miss the adventure and the uniqueness of feeling that you're living your dream and you're doing what you're meant to, rather than just following the herd and doing what I guess society has trained you to do. And it feels, I don't know you, Pablo, for me it feels empty at times.
I definitely feel the same. And I pretty much landed, you're right, to Australia, and I was back up to my old job. So, which in one hand was very good, because pretty much I didn't have to look for a job. But at the same time, after a few months, I realized that it doesn't feel right. It's just we're missing that part. And so I'm trying to sort of find my own adventure in Sydney. That's somehow what I'm trying to do with my career. So I'm also trying to move a little bit from what I'm doing and I want to do something a bit more exciting, because, yeah, you just miss that adventure side. And as Dini said before, we are not the typical people that want just to have a quiet and controlled life. People here are very into have everything in control. They want to feel that, but there's no control, really. There's, you know, one day you're here and one day something could happen and all is gone. So you have to live the life to the fullest, and that's probably what we're missing.
And I imagine the two of you have got some dreams of travel floating around there, aren't there?
Absolutely. Well, we've still got the Caribbean and the Pacific pending on the sailing. Although I think for the moment we've decided to wait till all three kids can swim and dive properly before we do the Pacific. But there's no doubt we will sail the Pacific one day. And in the meantime, yeah, we are trying to define what our dreams are. And for me, that sailing dream really was always by far the biggest and strongest. So I have days where it just feels like all is done now and really there's nothing left to do. And then if I try and dig deeper, there is, you know, some other ideas we always had. One is buying a piece of land in South America where I can build a self-sustainable farm and run some yoga retreats. From Pablo always wanted to live in Asia for a few years somewhere. So just a couple of weeks ago, we almost ended up in the Solomon Island with AusAid, the development agency of the Australian government. So we are sort of shopping, looking around a little, but I think for a little while we'll stay here. The kids are very happy. The kids are happy anywhere. It's another question I get asked a lot, whether they're happy on the boat, whether they're happy on land. To kids, it doesn't matter. As long as the parents are happy and there for them, they couldn't care less where they are. The one thing I've continued, or I am continuing from the boat that started on the boat trip, is running those yoga retreats.
I saw that you've got this big yoga retreat in Bali coming up, and that looks amazing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so earlier it was quite easy to, when we were still on the boat, wherever we'd sail to, I'd organise the next retreat. So I had to somehow redefine it when we came back to Sydney, but kept it with the idea of I'd run it in places where we really want to go. And we almost ended up in Bali before deciding to go back to Sydney. So it's a place that's always really attracted me. It's obviously the mecca of yoga itself. And I'm really happy with the place I found to run the retreat. And very excited. Already a few people who'd come to my Malta and Turkey retreats have signed up, and so it'd be nice to see them again. And hopefully a few new faces also.
And that was the story of Dini and Pablo Martinez on the Life Aquatic on Boat Radio. You can read all about their adventures and their life back on shore on their blog, sailingyogafamily.com. That's sailingyogafamily.com. I'm James Finlayson, and that was the Life Aquatic on Boat Radio.